Plains.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be here. I want to thank my co-authors for the information and data that they provided, but warn them and you that I'm barely able to present half of what they sent to me. They had a lot of excellent thoughts and ideas, and I hope that there is time during our discussion period that we can talk about those things more. But because my time is so short and so limited, I'm going to have to read my talk today because I am easily distracted when I get to talking about these things. So I apologize if a read talk is horrible for you. This is the problem. Models forecast Great Plains climate to become warmer, drier, and more variable in this region, with longer growing season, increased ET demand, and more extreme events. Demand for cereal grains is forecasted to double by 2050, but production increases will have to come from existing farmland. Demand for urban use water will likely cause some irrigated land to revert to dry land production. However, as most of you are well aware, farmers across the northern and central Great Plains have always dealt with a highly variable climate, and note the huge year-to-year variability in annual precipitation at these five Great Plains locations. These are the potential mitigation strategies that I'll be talking about: no-till and tall stubble to increase non-crop period precipitation storage efficiency, and fraction of ET that is transpiration, increasing system intensification, that is, reducing fallow frequency, crop sequencing within a rotation to minimize impact on the subsequent crops, and flexible opportunity cropping based on stored soil water and precipitation forecast, and finally diversification with forages, pulses, and oilseeds. Dry growing season conditions in some years can result in short plants, such that conventional grain headers with a sickle cutter bar sometimes must be set close to the ground to harvest all of the grain, leaving very little standing stubble, as seen on the left. But use of the stripper header results in much more standing residue, seen on the right, which will benefit snow catch and improve stored soil water supplies. On a silt loam soil at Akron, an extra 2 inches of soil water, and sometimes even more than that, much more than that, can be stored due to increased snow capture. Akron has a unique environment. It gets about 3 blizzards each winter, and nearly 75% of the snow that falls on unfrozen soil. This, of course, is not the case in the northern plains, but could be if the climate warms. These data from Merle Vigil are from a 4-year rotation at Akron, Colorado, where the wheat and millet crops were both harvested with a stripper header or conventionally cut with a sickle bar header. The 4-year average yield responses to tall residue from stripper header harvest, which are the yellow values, were 8 bushels per acre for wheat, 9 bushels per acre for sorghum, and 17 bushels per acre for proso millet. These were associated with greater stored soil water where the stripper header had been used. These data from Herb Cutforth at Swift Current show a somewhat different situation. The black dots show a clear increase in the average wheat, canola, and chickpea yields associated with increasing stubble height of the previous crop. But the height treatments were imposed after winter, so presumably all the plots started at the same water content. The yield increases were attributed to microclimate improvements as stubble height increased. Total water use was not affected by stubble height, so the increases in water use efficiency, those are the red points, were attributed to greater proportion of ET being used for transpiration and less for evaporation as stubble height increase. So use of a stripper header is a management tool that could be used to mitigate some of the projected deleterious effects of climate change in the Great Plains. Now let me make the case for forages. Because forages are harvested prior to physiological maturity, water use is less than for full-season seed crops. At Akron, Colorado, the forage water use is typically 60% of the seed crop water use. Additionally, forage yields are less susceptible to the detrimental effects on yield of water stress during reproductive stages that occur with most seed crops. These data from John Holman at Garden City, Kansas, show the potential forage production in that environment. These rotations employed forage sorghum, winter triticale, and oat under no-till and minimum till management. The first phase of four of the rotations, that's these, if I got, is there a pointer here? Yeah, these right here, this first phase, whoops, is double cropped.
Do you look for a pointer, David?
Well, the instructions that were sent to me said, use the mouse.
Well, they didn't give us a mouse.
So
they gave us.
I'm using this thing here.
I don't think we have.
Because
here's your pointer.
Because
right
they said that's the only way it gets recorded, is if you do this.
Okay.
So, you know, I'm kind of a rule follower, and if the ASA says do this, I'm going to do it. So anyway, back to the Kansas data here. The first phase of this, a point, is a winter triticale and forage sorghum that's grown in the same year. It's double cropped. The annualized dry matter yields range from just over 5,000 kilograms per hectare to just over 8,000 kilograms per hectare. So these are acceptable productivity levels, especially considering that the 2013 oat crop produced nothing. The alternative crop rotation experiment at Akron, Colorado was started in 1990, and several of those rotations were established from existing rotations in 2011 to compare productivity of systems which included forages and flexible crop choices as a strategy for dealing with variable climate. This five-year data set compared five set rotations, those are the yellow bars, against three flexible rotations, and those are the red bars. The rotations are compared based upon net income generated by the rotations rather than the yields because of the disparity in yield mass between forage crops and seed crops. The flexible rotations had a cropping decision of whether to crop or fallow and which crop to grow based upon the expected yield, which was calculated from available stored soil water at planting and the average growing season precipitation put into a water use yield production function. Then all forage rotation of forage millet, forage triticale, and forage sorghum, that's the tall yellow bar, sorry, I've lost my place. That's the problem with reading. So that tall yellow bar generated the most income, over $700 per hectare. The wheat, forage, sorghum, flex, and wheat flex 1, flex 2 rotations, which are the red bars on the far right, ended up being continuously cropped. That is, our decision model didn't call for a fallow period ever to be used, and had four of the 5 years in which the flex phases were grown had forages rather than seed crops grown. So they were heavily influenced by forages. The flex crop in the wheat grain crop flexible rotation, I'm going to try the pointer again, right here, was millet in four of the years and grain sorghum in 1 year and was not an economically successful system. The flexible rotations employing forages and the set all forage rotation, that's the tall yellow bar and the two red bars on the right, were clearly more successful than the four set seed rotations, which included fallow. If these forage systems are economically so much superior to the set grain-based rotations, then why do we not see farmers jumping on the bandwagon and producing forages like crazy? Okay, I'll answer my rhetorical question. I think it's because tradition. They know how to grow wheat, and we're just going to grow wheat or corn. They don't want to grow these other things. They may have to buy new equipment if they got to do forages. And there's a huge labor requirement to producing forages, and that's work. We were surprised to see that when the four fixed grain-based systems were analyzed separately, the wheat fallow system produced more than double the net income of the wheat corn fallow, wheat millet fallow, and wheat sorghum fallow systems during this five-year period. This is different from some previously published research, which shows the more intensive systems, two crops in 3 years, to be more productive. But again, the main point of the figure is that the systems incorporating forages are much more productive than the grain-based systems and likely are less subject to detrimental impacts of lower precipitation periods. These are some thoughts from Herb Cutforth in Saskatchewan. He said there has been a change in cultivated tilled wheat fallow to no-till or minimum till. The new systems incorporate pulses and oil seeds into rotations with wheat. There has been new research regarding incorporation of short-term grasses in rotations, and as previously mentioned, seeding into taller standing wheat stubble results in about 10% greater yields of subsequent crops than seeding into cultivated fields, a result of shifting more of ET into transpiration and away from evaporation. These data from Gann et al. In 2015 at Swift Current show that the lowest system yields came from the system with fallow between the wheat and durum phases. That's these bars. I need to get a pointer right here. So there's fallow between the wheat and the durum systems. And these two systems here where the fallow is replaced, this one with a pulse crop and this one with a cereal crop. The relationships are the same whether it was the dry years, which are the black bars, or the wet years, wet and normal years, which are the red bars. Although the wheat pulse durum and wheat cereal durum systems do not appear to be very different, those are these two sets of bars to the right, in the center and the right, they are dramatically different in their nitrogen use efficiency because of the pulses fixing nitrogen. These data from Perry Miller are from a four-year study at Bozeman, Montana, which consisted of two cycles of two-year rotations. The first 2 years were spring wheat and spring pea, and the last 2 years were winter wheat and winter pea. The data were compared using net returns from each system. The highest net returns were observed for the seed pea wheat rotation, and the lowest were from the forage pea wheat rotation, where the pea was left as a cover crop that was not harvested and the residues were left on the soil. In that same study, Perry and his colleagues further compared wheat production systems in which the fallow phase was replaced with forage pea production and showed the value of having the end-fixing peas in the system. The two box plots on the left, these two here, are the net returns from the treatments where end fertilizer was fully supplied to the wheat crop, and the two box plots on the right, these two here, are the treatments when end fertilizer was supplied at half of the full rate. The spread shown in the box plots indicates the variability in the net returns when half the fertilizer was applied in the forage pea wheat system. So I'm going to get off of my notes because that's too hard to understand. See the spread in this bar and the spread in these two bars? They're essentially the same, and the means are essentially the same. So when you've got half the N applied, but there's nitrogen in the system, your variability is the same as if you had all the N in here. What Perry is trying to point out here is that when you've got a set of circumstances in which you're going to be short of nitrogen because of the climate is such that the nitrogen in the residue is not cycling fast enough into the system, and you're going to be short, it is better to have had the legume in there because it makes up for the shortfall of the nitrogen. I'm going to read what he actually said. The nitrogen supplied by the pea essentially protects the wheat yield and or protein levels under varying infertility management, which can reduce the farmer's exposure to economic variability. Consequently, under a likely more variable future climate causing variation in the amount of N becoming available from existing crop residues, and variation in protein content of wheat seed due to variable precipitation, pea and other end-fixing legumes in the systems can stabilize production and net returns. Here's some thoughts from Pat Carr. Cool season pulses, for example, field peas and oil seeds, for example, canola, are being grown by Montana farmers and can be used to diversify wheat-based cropping systems. However, these crops fail to expand cropping systems beyond cool season choices and limit the agroecological benefits that may result when warm season crops are incorporated into rotations. Warm season crops such as proso millet have and are being grown to a limited extent for grain and seed, but even with changes in climate, they remain a challenge to grow in northern latitudes. This table presents average high and low temperatures for moccasin in central Montana and Akron in northeastern Colorado, where proso millet is a highly adapted crop. the average difference in maximum and minimum temperatures for July, August, and September are about 4 degrees C. When coupled with the likelihood of late spring frost, which delays seeding until late May, even quick-growing warm-season crops like buckwheat and proso millet can sometimes be a challenge when grown for grain at northern latitudes. However, this could change if the predicted warming of the climate occurs, making millet a more adapted crop. Yet the problem will remain that millet is birdseed in North America with a limited market. If the market could change to a human consumption market for millet, then diversifying future northern Great Plains rotations with this warm season crop will become a more viable option. Don Tanaka and his colleagues at Mandan, North Dakota, have suggested that a strategy for dealing with increased climate variability is to employ dynamic cropping systems. These consist of crop sequencing to optimize crop and soil use options to attain production, economic, and resource conservation goals using ecologically based management principles. It is a form of opportunity cropping or flexible cropping, but with many more factors to consider than just the yield. The problem with employing dynamic cropping systems is that as a producer moves from monoculture, like wheat fallow on the left, to fixed sequence rotations like wheat corn fallow in the center, to dynamic cropping systems on the right with increasing diversity, the production complexity and agronomic knowledge and management skills required of a farmer also increase. For example, he may need to know if planting, fertilizing, weed control, harvesting, and marketing information for 6 or 8 or 10 crops instead of 1, 2, or 3. He will also have to be aware of effects of previous crops on subsequent crops. There is another potential problem in that the dynamic system can have crop choice decisions based on the expected environmental conditions that are being forecast. But if you have ever followed the forecasts for precipitation and temperature that come from NOAA's Climate Prediction Center, you realize just how really poor and unhelpful those forecasts are for planning purposes in the Great Plains locations. Consequently, dynamic cropping systems decisions should probably be based upon other considerations such as stored soil water, diversifying the rotational sequence to better control weeds, or favorable markets and crop prices. This is a figure from Mandan, North Dakota research that has appeared in a couple of publications, but the full data set has not been published as far as I can tell. The bars represent the spread in observed spring wheat yield, the max and the min, for three systems at Mandan, North Dakota. The lines are the 10-year means. The red bar is a spring wheat, winter wheat, sunflower rotation, a 3-year rotation. The yellow bar is a spring wheat, winter wheat, pea, corn, soybean rotation, 5-year rotation. And the blue bar is the dynamic cropping system. It is unfortunate that these systems were not evaluated based on the production of all of the crops in each system. And not just the spring wheat. Just looking at spring wheat yield could lead to some erroneous conclusions, in my opinion, as the max and mins are based only on 1 year of data, so it would have been better to show a variability statistic like CV or standard deviation about the mean in order to really conclude that variability was reduced by the dynamic system, which is what Don Tanaka concluded from this graph. The problem here is that the previous crop could have had a major impact on the minimum yield attained by the spring wheat crop in 2006. So I'm talking about the bottoms of these boxes here that are labeled 2006. Those are the yields in 2006. Mark Liebig told me that the crop previous to the 2006 spring wheat crop in the dynamic system was soybean. What I'm getting at is that the previous crop, if it had been sunflower, then the spring wheat yield in 2006 could have been much lower. The bottom of this box would likely have been way down here. What we can do, though, is compare the minimum shown for the 5-year rotation for the dynamic system, since they are with this one for the 5-year rotation, these two, because the previous crop in both of those years was soybean. And it does appear that the dynamic system did result in higher yields, especially under these stressful conditions in 2006. But again, looking at the yield of only one crop in the system is a little dangerous for concluding that the dynamic cropping systems will increase yields and reduce yield variability. These are my final thoughts. Cropping systems that are more adaptable to a changing or more variable climate will likely be more diversified and include forages, oilseeds, and legumes, and perhaps integrate livestock. These systems will have some ability to employ annual crop choice decision-making, that is, not be fixed rotations. And these systems will use management tools such as stripper headers, no-till, intensified rotations, minimizing fallow periods, and skip row planting, which I didn't talk about, but we can talk about during the discussion period, to increase precipitation storage, system productivity, and net income, and mitigate some of the detrimental effects of a changing climate. Thank you.